Philip, what's your beef with science right now?
Well, that's a very tough question, but I think my biggest beef is actually that, you know, you have this really nice saying that science is like standing on the shoulders of giants, right? And every generation of scientists is providing a small puzzle piece and then people further down the line build on it. But I feel like that kind of system is crumbling because people are injecting like false or incorrect or not very well done research into the system. And that kind of makes the whole science building unstable.
What do you think, Chris? Is science unstable?
Science is definitely unstable. From a day-to-day perspective, I think it's unstable. Right. But I think this has always been true, even from the days. Well, I mean, they had like alchemists and whatever at some point. So it's always had to contend with these charlatans and lying and stuff like that.
Which beer do you want? You want the Weizenbock?
Yeah.
Great. Take this one. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. To science being shitty.
Oh, it's not that shitty.
Not yet, but maybe in the future.
It's really good. You said on a day-to-day basis, science is a bit flawed and not really stable.
I completely agree with Phil. I think that what I can't tell is if it's happening more frequently now, but people lie. And they have lied in scientific communications, and it keeps coming up about unreproducible papers. And we've all probably got stories from our own research where we've found a really exciting paper, tried to do what they said they've done, and it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, makes you distrustful of science and makes you think, because our whole point is reproducibility.
Well, the worst reason for irreproducibility is if someone lied, right? That's of course the worst case. If they faked part of the paper or intentionally left pieces out that you would need to know to reproduce it.
Yeah.
But assuming this isn't happening, because most of the time it isn't, right? Sometimes it's some other reason.
Yeah, people make mistakes.
Yeah.
Or at the time they leave out information that they didn't know was important. So this happens a lot in chemistry where they didn't know something and then later on find out that, or it turned out to be some particular, like one of the big ones is the wetness in the air in the lab. So they had things working during the winter and then in the summer it stopped working.
Yeah,
and it was just because of the water in the lab, in the air in the lab.
Same for animal work, that some factors are like really dependent on the season of the year.
Mm.
And if you don't record like which season you actually did your experiments in, you might not be able to reproduce it at all. I did the scientific writing course last week and they were talking about big fraud and little fraud. So like big fraud is like you just go out and say, claim something that's absolutely wrong and you didn't do the experiments and whatever. And I don't think that's super critical because you can easily kind of track that down. But the difficult part is like this, the little fraud. It's like you do a set of experiments and you have one set that worked and you did it like six times and it worked two times and then you just report on the two times and you just conveniently forget about the other four times and you're not telling anyone about it. And it's really hard to track down because you actually did the experiments, right? Everything seems to, like it looks like a paper, it reads like a paper, the data looks how it's supposed to look, and still you can't reproduce this because they are, like you don't know about these other four experiments that just didn't work.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's a huge problem that selective reporting of results is, and people are trying to stop that from the top down, from like drug trials all the way now. You were talking, Hannes, recently about what if it was we were to report our experiments or record publicly what we were going to do in our experiments before we attempted.
Yeah, I think what I was referring like to is, right? Is now was like pre-registering molecular studies, because we already pre-register clinical studies, and this is of course utter importance there. But I was thinking if this is actually possible with molecular studies as well, or preclinical trials or something like that.
So in a way, I don't think it's necessary, because if you look on a single publication basis, yes, that publication has lied. But the way the citation system works is that if a publication is good and useful and reproducible, people will use it and then they would cite that paper in their own study, the next one along. And so publications that are reproducible should survive through the site, like being cited more and more and more. Whereas a publication which was wasn't actually fraudulent, but was selectively applying the data, that one would die and wither because it would stop being cited as much as the other study. And you would then choose the study that has been cited the most. So there's a kind of natural selection going on.
It would be a good case. On the other hand, we also know that publications kind of disappear. They collect dust, and at some point you find this publication from the 80s, which hasn't really been cited, but now it's super exciting because because you do something similar.
Yeah.
And people didn't really pursue it for maybe 40 years.
Mm.
This doesn't mean the publication from the 80s was shit. It just means we went in a different direction or something.
Yeah, there are too many layers to that. So there's that citation count is not uniquely about the reproducibility of the data. It's also about big names and
University
of Philadelphia.
Hotness of the topic and stuff like
that. Hotness, so important.
And I feel like in a perfect system, you would be absolutely right. Like, good stuff gets cited more.
Mm.
But I think in the reality of how citations work, it's like if you come first and you describe something that worked, like basically like positive result bias, then everybody else has to prove that, like has a way harder time actually proving you wrong, because people are always going to point to that paper going, oh, no, but you're wrong. Like, you're just shit at your job. That's why you can't reproduce it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it's really hindering the progress of science. If you come out and show something works, then maybe a PI decides to put a PhD on that project. You spend 2 years trying to reproduce it. And maybe you figure out, oh, the protocol was shit after all. It's not just me. But then you're already like knee deep in that project. So you have to publish, and you have to publish something positive, else you're not going to have any chance. Mm-hmm. So I feel like you're producing a lot of work on just one positive claim you had at some point.
The thing is, our scientific system is, as you called it once, Chris, is the absolute, the best way right now we have to assess if something is true or not. And on the day-to-day basis, we have many of these papers that would be selected out of the system because they might not be as reproducible, because they might not have been well done or whatever. But since they are published, since they pass this truth standard, the scientific peer review process, it is now factual true, right? The test of time might fail it, but we don't have a system right now to report on that. The retraction system in journalists doesn't work.
It's we don't have a post-publication
review process either.
Yeah.
And no proper way of commenting on things. There are websites now that can do that, but we don't have a formal system for that.
No, and I think this is the big question for our era of science. Because before, science was different, at least when I read history books about science, about chemistry certainly, and other areas of science in, say, the 50s or 60s, it was personalities maybe who had an idea, but then one would write one paper saying, benzene is circular, and someone else would write one being, no, it's a cube, and they would fight it out. And so you'd see in the written record that neither was right until more evidence builds up and more papers come out, until we go for a flat benzene ring, and then everyone's like, oh yeah, it's cool, okay, and they accept it. Whereas now we write monolithic papers that enter the library and become hallowed, and people do, it's not true, but in general you're right, like they are accepted now as true rather than being steps on the way to truth, which is really sad. There are, like you said, there are more and more people are starting to discuss this because it's become a problem.
We have these tools online now, but I think the progress there is kind of slow, and people are very hesitant to engage in these discussions.
I think it depends on the field, but what you were describing, like this back and forth between certain people, I think that's science at its best, right?
Mm-hmm.
As long as both teams, both sides are doing their very best to disprove the other team, then that's amazing. If they record all the data, someone can go back and say, oh, both were kind of right or kind of wrong. And that's where the coolest results come from, right?
Mm.
It's like if both of them do a good job and there's no fraud, big or little, involved, then it's amazing. And it might take 55 years or whatever for someone to actually have this idea to go, oh, amazing, this is how it actually works. But if like all of that literature is kind of riddled with small mistakes, then you can't draw any conclusions. Like you would have to do all of this work again. And this is what actually happens. I feel like a lot of work is done over and over and over again because either people can't publish their negative results, or because someone published something with the wrong buffer or whatever, and then you have to like figure it out on your own.
So I think that's definitely totally true. And I think just it's always been true. And science takes longer than any of us care to imagine. It will take for real, useful, reproducible knowledge to be produced. It takes more than one life, more than one scientist's working lifetime before things actually get accepted. I mean, that's kind of why the Nobel Prize takes so long to come through. They want to wait long enough for the thing that they're going to award to be as like solidly proven. I wonder if there are any Nobel Prizes that have been retracted.
No, I don't. But there are a couple. We could make a whole episode on Nobel Prizes that should.
Can we
be modified?
Yeah. Can we also do Nobel Prize winners that go mental? Because there's a lot. There's a trend for people who get Nobel Prizes to go insane after they've got the Nobel Prize and study ghosts. Are you talking about
Linus Pauling?
What did Pauling do? Was he ghosts?
He was like really into vitamin C, and that would cure everything, including cancer. And then I think he died of cancer. I'm not sure.
There's a professor at Cambridge who got a Nobel Prize and asked for money to set up an institute that studied ghosts. And Crick or Watson became massively racist.
Watson,
I think he was always racist,
but he then thought he was okay for him to say racist things outwardly.
But that's a huge trend. Like I don't know. Like I heard about this one. That was always the thing, that you had like actual amazing scientists or like engineers or something, and then they also had like a side business in like tracking down the monster of Loch Ness or. Trying to figure out if ghosts are true, or looking for, what is the other one, the Yeti or the Bigfoot. So I think that's a long-standing tradition in science.
Is that maybe how you become a Nobel Prize winner? You have to, part of your personality has to be on towards an end where you look for like very out there ideas or whatever, and are prepared to think about those sorts of things.
And we are in the city of the Nobel Prize. You can ask the people on the committee. They're probably one of this building right now.
Oh my god, let's do it.
Let's hunt them down.
somewhere wrong. Somewhere that let's hunt down a Nobel Prize winner.
That's not the winner, the person on the committee.
But they are just looking at the science themselves that they produce, which right? They are not making any predictions about what kind of qualities are going to lead to a great scientist or a potential Nobel Prize winner, right?
No, I don't think so. Although there is a tendency now, or I've heard that there is a tendency for the Nobel Prize committee to enjoy the story now is where the Nobel Prize, the person who had the idea that becomes the Nobel Prize, they were originally tried to sell this idea contrary to the accepted scientific wisdom, and they then had to battle and battle and battle and prove it. Like, so quasicrystals was a big story like this. They kept getting told, no, you're wrong, these things can't exist, you're absolutely wrong, and then eventually they built up enough evidence, and then quasicrystals got the Nobel Prize because the Nobel Prize committee liked that. Whereas if you're just good and you come into this with an idea that everyone's just like, wow, that's a really good idea, that's no longer a good story for the Nobel Prize committee. So
I think there are a couple of reasons to get like a Nobel Prize, right? Like one of them is like you basically have disproven a whole field during your career. But if you're the father or mother of a whole new field that no one has even thought about before, that might as well be a really nice story and thing to give this award to, right?
Thing I didn't realize and only sort of have heard snippets of it recently is that getting a Nobel Prize requires quite a lot of political lobbying. And so we were just talking about networking at conferences, and part of some of that networking is because people are trying to get them either onto the committees or to get their name around so that people kind of go, oh, this person, they are the father or mother of this technique, whereas it's always more messy than that, but they have to just keep selling themselves as that thing until eventually. Anyway, back to why science is shit.
I think we all like science in general.
I mean, I like the ideas of science, right?
Yeah.
I'm just shocked by the reality of it when you're like kind of in the middle going, well, this does not
Sounds a bit like a whiny PhD student right now.
Well, I am a whiny PhD student. Isn't every PhD student sometimes a whiny PhD student?
We don't want to all just sit around whining out there in case people take away our funding and be like, it's probably nicer to leave these PhD students out into the real world.
No, what we just complained about was this day-to-day process, which is subject to these small human mistakes, which we make all the time. On the long run, though, science does work, right? Because of scientific progress, we have done things that were completely unthinkable, like landing people on the moon or a probe on an asteroid, the thing a few years back. Yeah, and then, of course, uncovering the mysteries of nature at this very small scale, like the nature of the atom, the elements, and all of these things. We're completely out of reach of any other predictive institution before.
Yeah, like I think so.
Philosophy or religion or anything like that.
Yeah.
No, I think, I mean, science, if you have like the long-term perspective, is doing an amazing job. And just in terms of progress we've made in the last, 250 years, it's absolutely bonkers if you think about it. Mm-hmm. Like the phone I have in my pocket is as powerful as the computer that sent people to the moon. And that computer was like a complete room. And I'm like complaining when my Skype is like having like a hitch and it's like a little bit of delay. It's like just like the progress even within my lifetime is just astonishing. And science is to blame. I mean,
Are we mixing up science and technology? Where's the line drawn here? Because the computer you have in your pocket is basically the same as the one that brought people on the moon, right?
No,
it's a different computer and different components and stuff.
For the moon? Yeah, they must have had transistors. Yeah, definitely, then.
Right.
But
it's still a computer. The computer is not a new technology. It's been around for a while. It just got better and better and better, but not because of science.
Yeah, no, but because of science. Definitely.
Then what's the difference between, you can call engineering science.
Or I think they're very close, but not the same. But I think you need, like, for a breakthrough engineering idea, you need, like, foundational science. And, mm-hmm. like, the interesting thing about science is, like, you never know where that kind of science information is coming from, right? It might be something that's, like, 100 years back or something. You're doing research about bats and that leads to sonar or whatever. Like, it's not, like, engineering kind of makes it useful, right? But then you need the science foundation.
If we go back to the phone analogy, so the science was done in terms of, say, electrolithography for making the chips with a higher degree of transistors per square centimeter. Mm-hmm. So that came up. Someone manipulating electrons, that came up. I mean, the big ones are more in the realm of programming and information capture, like the algorithms that work to compress the data into packets and fire it across the network.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost like pure human reasoning built on the technologies of the space shuttle, but there are probably whole new theories that are being used to compress that data, and certainly cryptographically there's new levels of that sort of thing built into the phones that didn't exist at the time.
Right.
But would you say that then math and like computer science is proper science? Because math is usually not put in the same category, right?
That's true in the sense, well, it's difficult. For me, I would say that finding something that is reproducible, that you can do repeatably, accurately, is part of the scientific
process. Well, math has to be because it's a deductive science, right? Not an inductive science. Everything that happens within math is true because all the premises are true, right? Because math is defined. It's not, we haven't found it.
Yeah, so the math is like the most repeatable.
That's where math is different from the other natural sciences.
But I think some people would disagree. I'm not sure if I would necessarily disagree, but I don't think that question has been thoroughly answered if we created math or if math is something that we are discovering. You could also argue that math is basically the absolute true ground and we are just kind of discovering what our universe is made of. like our the fabric of our reality might be math.
This is an argument, I guess, potentially valid. From the formal philosophy standpoint of inductive and deductive science, this stays the same. This doesn't change, right?
Mm.
And deductive reasoning is per definition true if the premises are true. This does not go for inductive sciences, for inductive reasoning, where I observe something, take a conclusion from it, and say it holds true because the observation is true, right?
Mm.
While in deductive science, I assume premises, and from that, I derive something, I deduce something.
I think there's two different like forms of the word true, like universally true in the mathematics sense, and true in the sense of the parameters under which you perform the experiment. You always caveat wet lab science or in that sense with a caveat, like under the conditions I was doing things in, this is reproducible, not
in mice.
In mice, yeah. Sadly, I did a lot of chemistry in mice. It was not reproducible. I think that's where you're kind of coming up against a philosophical word, true, and then what the working definition of true that we use every day, because it's impossible to get to an ultimate truth for what we are going for.
There is a formal difference in true between inductive and deductive reasoning. Again, because deductive reasoning is derived by something that is true, and inductive reasoning is based on other assumptions.
Mm.
So they call it theory-laden, because you have to assume things beforehand in order for this model to work, and then, of course, it's confined to the model and the assumptions, as you just said. So there's an inherent difference between that, which is the difference between math and our natural philosophy, we could call it, natural sciences.
It would be interesting to get a mathematician on this podcast to ask them the same question. Is maths undergoing its own crisis in publication? I wouldn't say reproducibility crisis, because you kind of assume that maths is inherent, like you're saying, like once the paper is out there that says something, that has to be like hold true no matter what. But I don't know enough mathematicians to ask them whether they feel that the pressures on university professors and funding models is causing the quality of maths publications to drop.
That would be very interesting.
I don't know much about maths in academia these days, actually. I mean, even though we all kind of have been educated in natural sciences, the actual exposure to mathematicians is very, very limited, for us at least. I got taught maths by a professor in physical chemistry, for example.
Yeah, I didn't get taught by formal maths professors in that sense. Mm-hmm. And anyone I know who studied maths went on to do finance and
sold out.
Didn't stay within the field. But then the field is also, you have to be... It's almost like pro sports in a way, because there's a lot of like myths that like beyond 35, you're done with your mathematical ability and this sort of thing, which I think is just a dangerous concept to have anyway for these sorts of things, because that puts off a lot of people who might be really good at maths. But, you know, the prevailing wisdom in the field is past 35. They're done. They're out.
Doesn't even bother.
Yeah. You should talk about mathematicians, not chess players.
It's the same. It's the
exact same. Are they the exact same people?
Well, I would assume there's a big overlap there, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting. I don't know. I think the most contact I have is with like statisticians, and even that is like super limited. And I think it's kind of different, right? I haven't heard about a big like breakthrough and statistics, but maybe I'm just not in the field. Like maybe there's like a lot of stuff going on and I'm just
Ashley,
not aware.
Got anything to comment?
She's working on it right now.
But yeah, we've talked about a couple of problems and like what we don't like about like the scientific progress, how it's going on right now. But do you guys have solutions? Like what would you pitch if you have like one wish for the science genie to like magically solve one thing, like what would be the thing you propose?
I want it to be proved that the science genie can actually reproducibly cause my wishes to come true.
That's what you would waste your wish on?
No.
Genie, prove that you are really a genie and that you can do what you're saying.
Put the genie in an iterative loop and it would just fall apart. Okay, I can definitely start with this one. I still haven't quite like got the end point to this idea, but a YouTube style comment system under papers would be really nice because of what we've talked about before, like the retraction system is too slow or non-existent. So if you could look at a paper and very quickly, or maybe like an Amazon review, like 5 stars. So you look at the paper and you go, oh, 2 stars out of 5 from 1,000 people who've tried to reproduce this work. Yeah, so like maybe an Amazon-style starred system. So you look at a paper, you really like the title, you're getting really excited about it, and you look down to the stars and it says, oh, 2 stars out of 5 of 1,000 people. Maybe I should take a step back and not use this paper's, whatever this paper's saying, or just take it with a grain of salt because it's like, may not be as good.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole host of problems with this system, like abuse. Would it be... Are you
Russian trolls.
Russian trolls. We don't have to be Russian, just trolls. No,
it could be biologists or something.
Yeah. I think biologists just coming into chemistry papers and being like, dislike.
You would have to verify the personality for sure, because you can't let like all the people comment that don't have the expertise.
But YouTube lets you do that, and the system works itself out. So do you... Because the other problem is, are you anonymous or not anonymous? So... Would you risk your career now by going on to your supervisor? Let's depersonalize this to like one of the big names in your field and trashing them online with your own name. Because even though that paper is rubbish, he will or she will try and make your life misery.
Yeah, if that's your reviewer.
If that's your next, so should you be anonymous? Run, so this isn't the catch-all system, but something like that so that you can get a very quick appraisal of the quality of the work or the reproducibility of the work quicker than we can currently have.
Yeah, so there are actually a couple of websites. We talked about this last week and during this course where you can do this. There was one option that's anonymous. Like I can't remember.
Papier? It's Papier?
Papier,
that's anonymous.
Papier
that's anonymous.
I love
you can
Papier.
Verify it, but it has all the social media problems, right? Yeah. I could make like 100 accounts and just trash the lab next door because I don't know they spit in my coffee or whatever. Yeah, whatever. Or and there's another website called like F100, and there's like 1, verified.
F1000.
Yeah.
So
it's like verified.
F1000000. See how that goes.
Verified scientists who like do it. And then like the difference you see between them is like the anonymous one is very critical and people are actually like hashing out the problems or the weaknesses of the paper. And for the F1000, it's a lot of, oh, this paper is amazing. So they are basically spotlighting the good papers.
Yeah.
And the Papier is like criticizing the bad papers, quote unquote.
So maybe that's the way to get around this problem is you have both systems and you have competing systems. And a bit like movie reviews, where is it Metacritic is always much, much more positive than Rotten Tomatoes because Metacritic reviews actual reviewers from paper.
Metacritic has both. And it's really interesting to sometimes see the difference between like the professionals at whatever, New York Times versus like what the public thinks.
So you guys into that movie system? Critics? I didn't know that about you.
Hmm?
Are you guys into movie critics? I did not know about either of you.
I'm not obsessed with it, but
okay. I mean, I don't think I ever read a single one. To be honest, really? That's how far
I'm into. Before I watch a movie, I have like a quick.
I never do
at, because I don't watch any trailers because they spoil too much of the movie.
Yeah.
But I have a look at if it has like a Rotten Tomato score of like 20. I'm like, yeah, maybe I don't.
I know sometimes those are the good ones to go for because those movies are just awfully bad. And
maybe, but you don't go for something that's like 45. Percent or something, if I'm on the fence.
I also quite like movies where, say, the public hate it and the critics loved it, or vice versa, because that's kind of interesting to see. So maybe in this publication, the MetaPub that assesses the two rated, so the anonymous and the
that would be anonymized. Interesting.
named reviewers.
Anonymous.
Anonymous? I'll go for anonymous. Because then you could see a paper which anonymously is slated, but is like with named people being like, oh, this is amazing, this person is wonderful. And like you can then read the paper and try and work out what is that a politics thing? Is that.
And you got to correlate that to the ranking of university.
Maybe, yeah, or there's all sorts of things. But that would be nice to see the system working in that way and see that, see the kind of cogs turning in people's minds.
Yeah, definitely. Like one example we looked at, and we were looking at Altmetrics. Do you guys know what that is? So it's basically like how they are websites, and you can have a look at how many people are tweeting about this, how many mentions on Facebook, has it gone into like big public, like big newspapers or something.
Altmetric is basically social media and popular science mentions, right?
Exactly, yeah. Stuff like that. And then you get like different metrics, like nice graphs and whatever. But so we were looking at this one paper, and it basically made the point that if you think about high blood pressure, everybody's thinking about too much salt. And they were making the argument, oh, it's actually too much sugar that's the problem. So very interesting against the field, like you were saying. Oh, it's like they didn't publish very high, but the alt metrics were very high and popular. People were talking about it, and then it went through like the Twitter mentions. There was a lot of like basically salt interest groups. So you basically tracked down they were funded by like big salt.
I didn't know there was a big salt. That's insane.
Yeah. Basically, like, yeah, I mean, all the salt companies kind of came together and are employing people to go like on Twitter and talk about these studies. So I'm not saying anything about the quality of that study, but if you have this kind of system,
yeah,
like these are things that you introduce
yeah.
to it. But I think it would be a really like a step in the right directions with all the caveats of social media that you're
some
introducing.
Some kind of post-publication peer review is absolutely necessary.
Yeah, and I mean, you could also just, you could be anonymous, but you have to verify that you are a scientist at a scientific institution, for example.
Or, Philip, what's your one big wish if you could improve science?
I think we have to change funding. I think that's the absolute, the way we distribute funding is absolutely bonkers. And it can't be, because right now you need to publish big to get the funding, and then if you get the funding, you can publish bigger, and then you get better funding, and you're just like putting more money into certain people's hands that go with the mainstream ideas.
It's like the big get bigger and the small get smaller.
Yeah, that's kind of the idea. That's one thing, and then you decrease the quality of science because your incentive is to publish as much with a big as a claim you can possibly make on that data to get it out there, to get the funding.
Mm.
And that's just it. I think it just corrupts the system. And I don't think that was the case like 100 years ago. I'm not saying that system was better necessarily. Maybe you had like very rich people who had like their own scientists.
I think gentleman scientists was the problem of that time. I mean, a very few people were doing science. And
but at least these people could like do whatever the fuck they wanted, right? You have like Darwin going for this super crazy out there idea and falling for 45 years.
Back
and
then, science was exclusive to people who had the money. Either you were born to a rich family and interested in science, or married to someone very rich and they could afford a laboratory for you.
Yeah, so I'm not proposing to go back there, but what I'm saying is like the way science has evolved, the public is paying for our work and it's not getting enough out of it, in my opinion. We're wasting a lot of science that can't be reproduced, for example.
We don't know that. I'm not sure that's, like, again, this is where it's like a very...
Sorry, we don't know what?
We don't know that this isn't the best system, right? That because I think you should test other funding models and assess what's the outputs are coming out as. Because we all say, oh, it's not working, the system's broken, but science is still being done. Things are appearing and work is being done, and maybe over longer assessment periods, it's fine. So I'm not sure this funding system is unfair to us working in it, and we feel aggrieved by it. But I'm not sure for the public that they see it that way.
Sorry, do we have alternatives?
Oh,
how to distribute funding? Yes. You could just have a raffle, basically. You just say we have that much money. And then we're going to give it to, I don't know, 150 random groups in whatever country.
But then is that fair? Is that the idea of selecting for the best science?
But at least like you foster variety and diversity of ideas and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
So, for example, Planet Money, It's like a really nice podcast if you guys haven't listened to it. It's really nice. They had one about how the tickets for the Boston Marathon, basically like the starting places for the Boston Marathon, mm-hmm. are distributed. And they have this really interesting system. So they have like four different ways how you can get it. You can either pay, you can do something for charity, then you can get in, you can be like the fastest, or you have to run like six local races and then you're in. And I think you could do like a similar system with like science.
Mm-hmm.
You either have something like the big name, big institutions, Harvard, whatever, they get their money. And then you have people who are randomly selected. And then you can just come up with a fairer system where you have like different things.
But I think like a combination might be useful, because it would be awful if the
that's what you're suggesting, right?
Yeah.
You're not just going for raffle the whole way.
No. That would be one possibility.
No, because like, I just imagine a system where, yeah, you roll the dice for 1 year, then someone does some really good research, and then the dice roll the next year and they're cut off because they can't continue after the fact in that sense.
But I'm not sure if the science would actually be worse in these cases. Maybe you just have like fund projects for longer. Maybe you get fund, like you have a random system, but you get funding for like four or 5 years.
I've heard arguments a lot about this, is like to make funding longer term periods, because it changes the way people think. And so you pick a researcher for life, let's say, or maybe shorter than that, but you really extend the funding period times, and that will change how people try and publish. So they're not going to go early on. They would do the baseline good stuff and like build the solid foundation, and then by the end of the 10th year, let's say, that once they're built on that, they can then plant the flag of the crazy idea that they were building all to.
And maybe have some buffer for failure, because in the current system, if you have to get grants every year, there's no buffer for failure. If you have an idea in mind and it doesn't work, and that takes about 6 to 8 months to maybe for you to figure that out, like, what then? Like, you need to publish something, and it's not acceptable to publish negative data. So what are you going to do? You publish the best data you have, and you're going to put the best spin on it, and then you're going to put like a little bit of popular science on top of it saying it's going to cure cancer. Boom, there you go.
In mice.
But you say that in mice very, very quiet. Very quietly.
Yeah. I still, Hannes is being coy here, but Hannes' plan for funding science is the best.
Sorry, do I have one?
Yeah, we talked about it in the pub. We were going to...
Wait.
Okay, this could be my idea now, because Hannes doesn't want to own this one.
Please, Chris, tell us about my idea.
Hannes' idea was to give every researcher £1,000 and let them do their science. Like, everyone, from master student upwards, just gets one set of money, and then you let it, like, let the system start from that baseline.
I don't think I ever said that.
You did. We can cut this shit out.
No, please keep talking. It's not weird.
Well, I don't really want to defend your idea.
Please don't. Go for it.
But I think it might be interesting. At least you have your own... I mean, £1,000 is maybe not enough. But at least you have your... You would have to have enough money to pay your own salary and to buy your own whatever stuff that you need, even as a master student or as a PhD or whatever. And if you as a PI want more money, you have to get more people, but these people actually have enough funding in and of themselves. So it's not like you're hiring more people that you actually can't afford. So you either have too many people, but then no one can do experiments, or you have not enough people to actually do the experiments, but you can buy a new microscope, which is also stupid. It happens all the time.
That was the end of the thought experiment, was like for say the physicists who have to use CERN or something, they all have to club together.
It's like a million master students going.
They all have to come together to do this one bit of experiment or whatever.
And so, everyone is chipping their £1,000 in. Yeah. I don't know if that would be necessarily a worse system than the one we're having right now.
I don't know about that. But you could do trials or something. Your mixed system of different, let's say, the entire pool of the NHS funding, that's like $10 million.
$10 million.
And NSF?
What do you mean by the
NIH?
NIH?
What did I say?
You said NHS, which is the British healthcare system. But
okay, assuming a funding body like SSF, some Swedish funding agency, and they have at their disposal, let's say, 10 million crowns, of course, is much more than that. And a quarter of this you would give to people who hand in very good applications, who have done very solid preliminary work already, and things that seem very promising. Another quarter is being is going to this raffle, and everyone kind of can apply to for like whatever amount of money, and they might get it or might not. And then another quarter goes to people who are willing to reproduce other studies half of the time, and then there's a quarter left. I don't know.
Yeah, that, you can have like a, their own pot for like reproductive, reproduce studies that reproduce other people's work, for example.
Reproductive studies.
Yeah. No, okay. That sounds very wrong. Right.
I think there does have very good data, actually.
I mean, that would be kind of interesting because you could compare the funding models to see which ones are producing. And this is again another problem: is how do you choose what is the one that's producing the best? What like what term? What measure do you use for best research? In most papers is not good because people then just make lots of small papers, and that's the other big problem: is this metric system doesn't work very well.
Yeah, it definitely does not award like the people with the highest quality of research.
Yeah.
But the people who know how to game the system.
The quality is so difficult to assess because basically only the test of time can tell if it's good or not, right?
Mm. But for example, if you would assume, if the impact factor of a journal is a really good indicator for the quality of the science, right? Then you would assume that all the groundbreaking stuff would be published in Nature and Science and whatever.
Yeah.
And then all the subpar small studies and small papers. But in reality, like we're talking about, if you're going against the field, it's most likely that your Nobel Prize winning paper, like your initial publication, will be in a very small journal because that's the only journal that's going to take a chance. And Nature is going to be like, no, you're like absolutely wrong because the field is something is saying something else. Mm-hmm. So like impact factor and citations, all that kind of stuff, it's definitely not the full story.
Yeah, we know it is a very poor measure for scientific quality.
No.
And novelty.
Yeah.
So what I really liked about that Boston Marathon idea is what they were saying is you can't keep people from cheating. If you have enough money and your own, let's say your only way to get into the Boston Marathon is to run like 8 local races. If you have enough money, you just pay someone to say, oh, I'm Jeff Bezos and I'm running these 8 local races, and then you qualify. And then on the last one, you actually show up and run the Boston Marathon. So you can keep people from cheating. The idea is that if you make the incentives right, if you don't give a shit and you have enough money, you just go in and pay the money. And if you don't have the money, you can run the local races and whatever, like for everybody kind of like taking into account how could people game the system. And I don't think that's the case in science at all. I don't think there's someone sitting down going, oh, there's like salami techniques where you have like all of these small little papers. How do we keep people from doing that? I don't think anybody, it's like, well, we look at your citations and we look at your publications and the impact factor, boom, either you get it or you don't.
It is changing. I follow a couple of blogs that look at kind of this area, and they can see how people are being added into publications spuriously, or whether they are like dual publishing or all these sorts of things. And like more and more data analysis is being done on, you know, how these things are coming. So it's early days, but there is view, like people are aware of it and are beginning to sort of investigate that.
I do think salami slicing, what you just described, does not have to be an issue. If I can quickly mention my wish for science.
Yeah, go for it.
Which I didn't have before, but now I kind of had some time to think about my wish during the last 15 minutes or so. I think it would be for us to have a system where our reputation as a scientist does not depend on how we publish and necessarily what we publish. That we need other measures for success. That first impact factor don't mean anything anymore, or citations. I mean, we all agreed on the fact that an impact factor is meaningless, but still, if we can publish at high impact journals, we do, right?
Yeah, if you have the choice, you would always go for it.
You would always go for it. Even though we all know it's bullshit.
But the aim is that you want as many people to read your paper. Because if people don't read your paper, even if it's true and the best science ever, if it's never read, it's no longer useful.
Mm.
Exactly.
And so by having it in a higher impact journal, no matter what, you get more eyeballs
per, exactly.
on, per work.
But at the same time, you're also supporting the system.
Yeah.
which of course we don't want to, but we do it for our careers. And that's fine in the system we have right now, but I would wish for a system that would not have this component. The direct link between the publication, first the number of publications, but also the impact factor of those publications with our value as a scientist. I think that's something we have to overcome.
Do you have a proposition of how to do that?
The one thing I mentioned before is that we have to get rid of journals altogether and have a unified database where each publication starts in from the same base level of impact, and a post-publication peer review system, like Chris mentioned it, would then select for the good papers and weed out the shitty papers. I think that's one part of the solution.
I mean, the idea is usually not to weed it out, right? Like, all the information you put out there should
be still available. It should stay there.
Yeah, but having some kind of, like,
be flagged
rating
like,
or...
Yeah.
Could I add to that, then, that system?
Absolutely.
Is that the search engine... We want a better search engine so that when I want to come across your research and I want to ask a question, it works so well that it pulls out the relevant piece of information to me. And maybe weights it with its reproducibility so that, you know...
I mean, you go on PubMed and you type in a literate question.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, how do
mitochondria work?
That's exactly what I use Google first before going through the kind of like scientific web of science and Scopus.
Yeah, if I want to get an idea, for
sure. They're not intuitive, and they also...
No, you have to speak their language.
Yeah, you have to speak their language. So, yeah, I definitely use Google and write the full question and then maybe try some different wording, but that's the start of that kind of thing.
With this very nice ResearchGate engine, this Q&A thing in ResearchGate, it's very likely that someone asked the exact same question that you have in mind already, maybe in a different context, but then you can go from there. That's kind of nice.
That's good.
But that's, of course, not what we want. We don't want a system where someone asked the same question before, but I want to be able to ask a machine a question, and it spits the papers that I want.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, one thing we haven't talked about at all is nanopublications, which I'm a huge fan of. It's basically the idea of publishing single experiments or like a group of very small experiments instead of publishing a Nature paper that has like 4 years of worth and two PhDs and a postdoc and whoever in there. You just go and say, basically you ask one question and then you answer that question and you put that one in a database that's searchable.
Yep.
And then afterwards, like after the year or the 4 years, you basically write a review of your own data and you put that one in Nature.
Because everybody... your story with air quotes.
Exactly, yeah. And the stories are interesting and necessary and all of that. But I think nanopublications would help alleviate a lot of the problems with like pressure to publish.
Mm-hmm.
Negative results. It's easier to publish like a small negative results. You're not saying, oh, I have like 45 graphs of none of it work. You go, well, we tried this, it didn't work, please no one else do this.
Yeah.
Or please maybe 5 people, but not 180 people worldwide wasting their time.
And also, like, if you have any like help, please comment underneath.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Oh, you forgot to add buffer. You're like,
exactly. Oh, did you have ATP in your PCI? You're like, oh.
There's this thing of being scooped.
Mm-hmm.
Which we are so terribly afraid of.
Yeah, everybody.
In a system
yeah.
with nanopublications where it can show this, I was the first one to do this experiment. That's not a thing. Like, if we envision the ideal scientific system, if we just bring it back into our minds, where we make an observation, we predict something, we do experiments on that, and then we publish them. In this system, there's no such thing like someone else also did the work and they wrote it down a week before me, and that's why my work is meaningless now. That's not a thing, right? In the scientific ideal.
Yeah,
and
no,
our current
be,
system
because
being
it's not
scooped
about people.
Is a huge problem. But when you didn't the first experiment and you put it out there, then you can kind of claim that.
Yeah.
But if a second person comes, does the same thing, or maybe a follow-up experiment on that, and then together you work out the story, that would be ideal for everyone, including all of society, because they fund our research. They don't want the competition, right?
I'm slightly less excited about nanopublications than you two. I think it's kind of interesting what you're envisaging, but humans are humans, and I think if you produced a system, a new system by which the thing was met, people would, like your Boston Marathon thing, people would find a new way to game that system. So maybe instead of doing whole suites of research, you would do lots of little starting experiments and just lay claim. You'd begin to lay claim to huge areas of research by just doing, you know, the early experiment of a lot of things and then walk away. And it's not
theoretically.
It's just to say that it'd be cool to be able to experiment with it and to test that system for a while and see.
As Philip said, again, in the Boston Marathon thing, there will always be people who try to cheat. And whatever system you make up, there will always be people who try to game the system. And that's something we can just be aware of, right? You can't do anything about it other than optimizing the system. But we don't want to have a thing like in, I don't know, I'm making something up, like in StarCraft, where people come up with new ways of beating the game, and then they release patches and patches and patches to like fight the innovation of the players.
But I like the idea. Maybe science needs a patch right now.
That's it. Is that the conclusion?
What should patch 508 BC?
No.
Is that the one we are right now?
Maybe, I don't know. But I feel like if I think about nanopublications, it's almost like GitHub. Like you can put your code out there, and maybe you're the first one who did it, but then you can have like people collaborate on it, and it's like you can make a bigger project out of it. And I don't know how well that works and software and all that, but I feel like it works a lot better if you have like a big project that was like started by someone, but then you have like main contributors.
Yeah.
And you have like the percentage of, oh, that person is like a 30% of the code written was by him and stuff like that.
What I find interesting is that all three of us, all of our wishes or fixes for science are related to the funding and publication system directly. Mm-hmm. And that's something I find very interesting because we have many things that need fixing in science, but at least according to the three of us right now, it is the publication and funding system. And this comes from a place where we don't have a lack of funding, right? We're at a very high-profile institute.
I mean, I'd say in... I could have more funding for my research, but I'd say in globally speaking, in relative terms, yes, we are in a good position. Very good space.
Yeah, but is it just that greed? Like we are doing well, but we want more. We want more money. We want more freedom, and for our own careers to get funded.
Yeah. I mean, I think. If I were not a scientist, if I were in the public looking in, I would be careful to give more money to scientists. I think it has to be very well placed and the right amount. Because if you give me more money, I'm going to use more money.
Yeah.
That's not the point. Like, there's no scientist going like, well, I wanted to do these experiments and now I get back.
Yeah,
get
back.
Like it didn't 50%. Work and here's your money exactly. Back. Like, yeah. I had a negative result and then I stopped and here you have like 80% of the money back. That's
thanks.
I mean, I would theoretically do that, but in reality, that's not how. No, if you give money back, you get less money next time. So cost efficient system in the first place.
Yeah.
System is weird. So just like, I have this very hard discussion with my girlfriend, like, that just putting more money into science is not a good way to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because like there needs to be a need and the right people and the right distribution of all of that funding as well.
Should you wrap it up here?
I think so, yeah.
That was pretty heavy.
Absolutely, yeah, it was very heavy. But also a lot of important stuff.
Yeah.
Right, thank you guys for listening. We've been Hannes, Finn, Chris. As always, we didn't introduce ourselves this time.
Well,
see you guys next time.
I'd prefer to keep this anonymous. Please give me money.
Work. Okay, we're bleep, bleep, and bleep. And see you guys next bleep.